This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 30, 2008, from Pacifica Station KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, senators in Washington question the consequences of secret law. John McCain reveals his market-based approach for healthcare. And we'll hear from North Korea and Haiti as part of our continuing coverage on the world food crisis. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Baghdad hospital officials say that fighting between Shiite militias and Iraqi and U.S. security forces has killed upwards of 400 people this month alone. A government security spokesman today put the death toll as high as 925. Most of the fighting in Baghdad has been concentrated in the sprawling low-income district of Sadr City. At least 13 people died there today. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has warned both Shiite and Sunni militias to surrender or face an intense crackdown. Meanwhile, the fighting has made April the deadliest month for U.S. troops in Iraq since September of last year. In Washington, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, is calling for transparency in the ongoing closed-door hearings on a major defense bill. McCaskill called for a vote to move the meeting into an open session, but did not receive a necessary majority of committee members. The Senate Armed Services Committee has been holding day-long meetings to craft the defense authorization legislation, a bill that directs policy and funding priorities for the Department of Defense. Committee members say the closed sessions are necessary to debate classified information. McCaskill argues that a relatively small portion of the bill is classified, but the rest should be debated in public. Representatives of 12 Palestinian armed factions today agreed to a ceasefire deal with Israel based on a plan Hamas submitted to Egyptian mediators. Rami Omagari has more.
The Palestinian factions agreed to the ceasefire deal after 2 days of meetings in Cairo. The ceasefire agreement will first take effect in Gaza, followed by implementation in the West Bank. The agreement came after Hamas submitted a ceasefire initiative to Egyptian mediators last Thursday. The deal states that Hamas will ensure the suspension of Palestinian attacks from Gaza if Israel will lift its blockade and cease military actions against the coastal territory for a period of 6 months. The Islamic Jihad faction did not sign into the agreement, but the armed group said it would not obstruct its enforcement. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has echoed the Israeli rejection of the ceasefire offer, saying Washington will continue to not engage with the Hamas party. Also on Wednesday, an Israeli airstrike on the southern Gaza Strip city of Rafah killed a Palestinian fighter and wounded at least four others. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Al-Midari in Gaza.
The Bosnian War Crimes Court convicted and sentenced two ethnic Serbs and a Bosnian Croat yesterday for war crimes against Bosnian civilians. Zach Badorf has more from Sarajevo.
The Serbs killed eight Muslims hiding in a quarry during the three-year war in the early 90s and were each given a 17-year prison sentence. In a separate trial, a 43-year-old Bosnian Croat received a 10-year sentence for organizing a massacre of more than 100 Muslim non-combatants and the destruction of their homes. Bosnian authorities are responsible for prosecuting low-profile war criminals, while top-level officials are tried by United Nations International Criminal Tribunal. Meanwhile, Bosnia is one step closer to joining the European Union. EU officials announced yesterday the nation has met the necessary conditions to sign a stabilization and association agreement. It's designed to increase economic ties between the bloc of European nations and the Balkans. Neighbor Serbia signed the agreement Tuesday, despite Belgrade's failure to arrest prominent war crimes fugitives, including a Bosnian Serb general indicted for genocide for the Srebrenica killings of 8,000 Bosnian Muslims. Relatives of the 1995 Bosnia massacre accused the EU today of lacking respect for human rights. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Sarajevo.
The Los Angeles Police Department's Internal Affairs Division has dismissed all complaints of racial profiling made against LAPD officers last year. It's the sixth year in a row that the division has taken such an action that even members of the city's police commission call baffling. Leilani Albano reports.
Of the 320 complaints that LAPD officers stopped, questioned, or otherwise confronted someone solely because of their race in 2007, 252 of those claims were said to be unfounded, while the remainder were dismissed either for insufficient evidence or because no misconduct was found to exist. The LAPD has been unsuccessful in finding a solution to the accusations of racial profiling, dating back to the year 2000 when a federal consent decree mandated a process for dealing with racial profiling complaints in the wake of the Rampart corruption scandal. In 2006, an independent consulting firm found that Latinos and African Americans were significantly more likely than whites to be asked to leave their vehicles and submit to searches when stopped by police in certain areas, but stopped short of saying the finding was a sign of racial profiling. Members of the city's police commission, which usually defends the actions of the LAPD, found it hard to believe that racial profiling did not exist in the city. But Police Chief William Bratton assured them that the LAPD is not a racist department. For FSRN, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
In recognition of the Bush administration's penchant for secrecy, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing this morning to analyze the threatening implications of the increased use of secret laws. FSRN's Najee Mujahid reports from Washington.
Critical to the viable functioning of a democratic government is transparency, shared responsibility, and a system of checks and balances. There is also a fine line to be drawn that acknowledges the necessity for exceptions to be made that allows for some secrecy, particularly when complete openness can become a threat to security. But at what point does secrecy threaten democracy? Senator Feingold and the Senate Judiciary Committee sought to address this issue this morning as they convened a hearing entitled Secret Law and the Threat to Democratic and Accountable Government. This was in response to the recent exposure of a 2003 memo that came from the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel, or OLC. The OLC, among other things, has the responsibility of interpreting law for the administration. While some, including senators on the committee, have perceived the legal counsel's memos and interpretations as legal cover for dubious actions and policy on the part of the president, John Elwood, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, put forth a different spin on that perception.
The purpose of OLC opinions is not to provide cover, even legal protection, for actors. Its purpose is to help the President effect his duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So before he undertakes action, he routinely asks us for legal advice on matters that might be subject to dispute.
The now infamous OLC memo of March 2003 stated that the president could authorize the torture of prisoners and was kept secret, even from Congress, ostensibly for reasons of national security. Chairman of the committee, Senator Russ Feingold, speaking to William Leonard, the former director of the Information Security Oversight Office.
Mr. Leonard, I assume you've read the entire March 14, 2003 memorandum by John Yoo.
Yes, I have, Mr. Chairman.
As a former head of the office responsible for implementing the president's standards for classification, did you see anything in this memo that should have been classified?
Absolutely nothing.
It should be noted that the Supreme Court concluded that legal interpretations and opinions which embody the agency's effective law and policy must be disclosed because it would be secret law not to do so. Testifying before the Senate, Don Johnson is a professor of law at Indiana University and served as an assistant attorney general to the Clinton administration.
In a democracy, the government must be accountable to the people, and Congress must know how the executive branch in particular is interpreting and enforcing statutes that are already on the books. The whole system falls apart if the executive branch is allowed to keep those interpretations secret.
Heidi Katrosser, a specialist on constitutional law, an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, warned against the normalization of these kinds of executive activities and beseeched the committee to put a stop to it.
These events turn the constitutional structure upside down, seizing for the executive branch the power not only to legislate, but to create secret alternate legislative regimes. The only thing that could make matters worse would be for such events to become normalized, in the eyes of Americans. I fear that we've already started down this road, and I urge Congress to use its substantial constitutional powers of legislation and oversight to make clear to the executive branch and to all Americans that secret law has no place in our constitutional system.
These types of interpretations and secret protocols from the Bush administration are being called into question. Last week, the Senate Judiciary Committee passed state secrets legislation that limits the president's ability to withhold information. The next step is to go to the Senate floor for a vote. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Najee Mujahid of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Senator John McCain unveiled more details of his health care plan. It's a market-based approach that does not focus on covering the uninsured. Instead, McCain focuses on cost and competition. McCain's plan is drastically different than the plans that Obama and Clinton have offered. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
John McCain's health care plan encompasses Republican ideals, competition, and the free market. Here's a promotion for his health care plan from his website.
So let's give every American family a $5,000 refundable tax credit so that they can go out across state lines and get the insurance policy that suits them best.
President Bush's health care plan provides tax incentives to employers so they can provide health insurance to their workers. McCain's plan, giving families a $5,000 tax credit and individuals a $2,500 tax credit, is a $3.6 trillion idea that would be paid for by shifting the tax incentive from the employer to the individual. Critics say this will provide incentive for employers to not provide health care to their employees. They would likely drop employer-provided health insurance, resulting in more uninsured. Karen Ackerman is AFL-CIO's political director.
His plan would push people out of employer-provided insurance and into the private market to deal with insurance companies on their own. It would mean those with pre-existing conditions simply will have an even harder time finding health care than they do now.
McCain's top economic advisor, Doug Holtz-Eakin, says competition will ensure that employers continue to offer health insurance.
Employers have attracted the quality of the workforce that they need to compete by offering an array of benefits that are attractive to those employees. Health insurance is an attractive benefit, and it's not attractive exclusively because of the tax benefit.
As McCain indicated in his promo, he would allow people to shop in other states for health insurance. McCain's advisor, Carly Fiorna, points to greater competition, which she says will result in lower costs.
He would allow patients as well to choose and purchase their health insurance from anywhere in the country. Instead of 50 separate markets for health insurance, he would create a national market for health insurance. And we know that competition and choice helps to drive down costs.
But Democratic-leaning critics say this is simply a giveaway to insurance companies who would escape states' coverage guidelines. Len Nichols is with the New America Foundation.
Well, this is a great example of ideology trumping policy.
McCain's market-based approach contrasts with the plans of the Democratic candidates. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama call their plan universal. It has a goal of covering all Americans, including the current 47 million uninsured. They offer a combination of government and private insurance options through tax credits and government subsidies to do so. Both Clinton and Obama set guidelines that require insurance companies to cover high-risk patients, including those with pre-existing conditions. McCain has not yet formulated his plan to ensure high-risk patients are insured. He says he will consult with the states. One of his ideas is to set up a nonprofit to contract with insurance companies to pool costs. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Please join us tomorrow as we present a special program in honor of May Day, International Workers' Day, where we'll hear about the hopes of workers from four continents struggling for dignity. We'll be back on Friday with regularly scheduled programming. Reverend Jesse Jackson led a delegation to assess the food crisis in Haiti 2 weeks after massive protests exploded over rising food prices. Nick Whalen reports from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Jesse Jackson said his visit was motivated by rising hunger in the hemisphere's poorest country as a result of mounting food prices. He met with President René Préval, Haitian senators, and residents of the sprawling slum of Cité-Soleil and promised to rally people in the United States to send food aid to Haiti.
Haitian blood is at the foundation of America's birth.
Sang haïtien li nan fondation construction États-Unis.
If Haitians, led by Louverture, had not defeated Napoleon in Haiti.
Si peuple haïtien pat bataille avec l'armée Napoléon.
Americans would not be speaking French.
Haiti's biggest provider of food, the UN's World Food Program, has warned that it has only received 13% of the $96 million it needs to fund its aid programs. Jackson said he would try to convince donors to supply Haiti with 30,000 tons of rice, 15,000 tons of wheat, and 7,000 tons of oil each month for a year. But he gave no details on how and when he could produce results. Some Haitians said they were skeptical. Ricardo Michel teaches at a free community school that accepts food from the World Food Program.
We have a series of problems facing us, and sometimes you need someone like Jesse Jackson, who is committed and is taking a nonviolent road to resolve these problems. That's been my style since I was in the United States. We've been working together since 1966.
At least one Haitian said he was confident that Jackson would come through. Father Gerard Jean-Just is a Catholic priest and supporter of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. 40 years ago, he and Jackson participated in the civil rights movement together.
Jesse Jackson said he's going to help us. It would be good because the youth need it. A lot of foreign organizations in the United States send money to Haiti, but we have a lot of people who take the money and don't do anything with it. That doesn't make us very confident about aid.
Jackson said he would launch a campaign in several U.S. cities next weekend to raise awareness of Haiti's food crisis. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nick Whalen from Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
The price of food is skyrocketing all around the world due to a combination of environmental and economic factors. North Korea is a country that's faced food shortages for a long time, and critics say the most prominent reason for widespread hunger is political. Yoon-ji Kang has more.
The food shortage this year in North Korea is the worst in the last 10 years. Because of disastrous flooding last summer, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that North Korea produced only about 3 million tons of food last year. The FAO says the country needs a minimum of about 4.3 million tons. In the 1990s, North Korea passed through a very difficult period of food shortages, during which many people died from starvation. North Korea called the difficult days the arduous march, but declared it had overcome them in the late 1990s. Lee Seung-yong is the general secretary of a humanitarian aid organization for North Korea called Good Friends. He says that today there are many signs last seen during the first arduous march.
Many circumstances are very similar to the time of the first arduous march. The shortage of food is about the same, and just like those days, the price of food is skyrocketing. Children are leaving home and begging for food on the streets. Families are being dismantled as many people leave home, or even the country, to find food. And soon children and the elderly will be starving to death. I'm very worried that a serious crisis is imminent.
The problem could be even more serious than 10 years ago. During the first arduous march, there was some international humanitarian aid available, though it was not enough to feed everyone. At the moment, external humanitarian aid is mostly blocked for political reasons. The so-called nuclear crisis and North Korean missile tests have led to sharp cuts in international aid. Even the newly formed government in South Korea is not willing to offer as much support as before unless the political conflicts are solved. Lee Woo-young, a professor of North Korean studies at Gyeongnam University, questions the linking of political and humanitarian issues in North Korea's case.
북한의 식량 문제라는 것은 그 정치 상황과 상관없는 굉장히 핵심적인 또 다른 인권 문제거든요.
While the new South Korean government is taking a harder line in its policy toward North Korea, I believe the food crisis of North Korea is a human rights issue that can't be tied to the political situation. When you say human rights issue in North Korea, many of you only mean political issue. But in the United Nations Convention, economic and social rights are considered most critical. The fact that people in North Korea are starving is a very serious human rights violation.
경제사회적 인권이라는 것이 굉장히 중요한 축이고 북한 사람들이 굶주리고 있다는 것도 굉장히 심각한 인권 침해거든요.
But many observers suspect that humanitarian aid is mostly distributed to the soldiers or to North Korea's elite instead of the people who need it most. They say sending more food to North Korea only helps to maintain the present regime. Professor Lee agrees that aid may be diverted, but he believes the total amount of food available is the most important thing. If the total amount of food available isn't enough, the first victims will be the weakest in society, including children, women, and the elderly.
The 10 years of sanctions on Iraq are a very good example. The sanctions failed to change the Iraq regime, and it was the weakest who had to bear the burden of the sanctions. To resist food aid to North Korea by saying most of the aid would be distributed for the military or upper-class people, in this context, is significantly inhumane.
But few aid agencies are prepared to give aid unless North Korea is willing to make the distribution transparent. Lee Sin-yong of Good Friends urges North Korea to change its attitude to persuade skeptical international view on it.
그런 부분에서 북한도 국제사회에 투명하게 정보를 공개하고
For an NGO like us, it's possible to offer unconditional help regardless of the political situation. But it's not the same for a government that is spending taxpayers' money. In this context, North Korea should expose the real situation regarding food, reveal the difficulties publicly and honestly, and appeal to the international community for help while making real efforts to improve transparent monitoring of the system of distribution. Right now, the most urgent thing is for North Korea to change itself.
It may be true that you can't help someone who won't say what they really need or who don't show a willingness to improve. However, we should keep in mind the saying, hungry children don't know politics. The food shortage this spring requires change, not just from North Korea, but from the South as well. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eun-ji Kang in Seoul.
6 months into a pilot program to allow Mexican truck drivers to deliver cargo anywhere in the United States, just 60 Mexican companies have been granted permits for only 66 trucks. For truckers, the program is made unattractive by the lack of cargo for the return trip, coupled with rising fuel prices. Company owners are afraid of making a hefty investment to join a program whose permanence is still in doubt, and all are worried about changing emissions regulations in California, which could bar many Mexican trucks from entry. On the U.S. side, the program has been under attack by truckers' unions and Congress members who cite safety concerns and question if the Department of Transportation truly tests Mexican truckers for English proficiency. Alonso Rivera and Mariana Martinez file this report.
Section 14 habla, señores, de transport.
We are at the Tijuana Commercial Driver School, where Pedro Antonio Valdez Triana is now taking classes to get his license to drive hazardous materials across the border. Valdez has been a cross-border trucker for 6 years and says he has no interest in joining the controversial pilot program that allows Mexican truckers to drive cargo all over the United States. To join, Valdez would have to make a $7,000 investment on his truck, including insurance. But he fears rising diesel prices that can be over $4.20 a gallon, double the ones in Tijuana, and cites the lack of business contacts in the U.S., that sometimes leave Mexican truckers like him with an empty return home.
Si haces un viaje largo que te va a llevar, por ejemplo, unas 8 o 10 horas.
If you make a long trip that takes, for example, 8, 10 or 12 hours in this case, and you come back home unloaded, 12 more hours, well, you're losing a whole day, a day plus the mandatory rest stops. So in the end, not even the expenses are covered.
Yo siento que pues los gastos no salen.
Valdez is not the only one showing little interest in the pilot program that started over 6 months ago. Only 60 Mexican carriers with just 66 trucks have been approved to bring cargo into the United States. And according to John Hill, administrator of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration in Washington, D.C., the uncertain future of the permits has been a key factor.
The biggest problem that we're having is the uncertainty of allowing the demonstration program to continue, which has kept companies from applying to participate.
The program has come under heavy pressure. During the first meeting to review the program, Senator Byron Dorgan said he is concerned about road safety because Mexican truckers answer a safety test in Spanish. He questions whether or not they actually speak English. But Everardo Monroy has been a truck driver for 10 years, including 4 years in California, where he worked the LA-Washington route, and he believes this lack of trust is unfounded.
I have no problem because I speak English, but I don't think it's that hard to learn the basics. Weight, dimensions, and street signs. I just don't see it being a danger for the United States. If there are incompetent drivers, you find those there as well as here. We know what we are doing.
Statistics back Monroy's claims. According to DOT statistics, since the program started, there have been no serious incidents or crashes, and out-of-service rates for Mexican trucks participating in the pilot program is just 10%, less than half the average for U.S. trucks and border crossing trucks, currently at 23%. The Motor Carrier Safety Administration's Hill adds carriers from Mexico have to pass even tougher inspections than in the U.S., including the inspection of their facilities and mechanical revisions every time they cross the border.
This is a requirement for Mexican trucks that U.S. companies today don't have to follow.
Added concerns for truckers dealing with the California border are the strict emission regulations that as early as next year might ask for more mechanical requirements and the mandatory use of clean diesel, not yet available in Mexico. Rogelio Vadillo, representative of National Chamber of Transport in Baja California, said trucker unions are asking that under NAFTA, Mexican truckers be asked to comply only with federal environmental requirements, more lenient than California laws. They also ask for Mexican truckers to be able to take advantage of financing programs already available for U.S. truckers.
Currently, we don't have access to financing. That is part of what should be discussed in trying to have a solution to this. And as I said before, the other problem is going to be diesel, because on the Mexican side, that type of diesel doesn't even exist.
From Tijuana, Mexico, this is Alonso Rivera and Mariana Martinez for Free Speech Radio News. Karen Miller contributed to this report from Washington, D.C.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback. Just drop us an email to comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Tina Gysi. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell. And our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From KPFK in L.A., I'm Aura Bogado.